Listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, last week, President Obama scored a victory with the payroll tax cut extension, at least a victory until February. Then we'll see what happens after that. We're going to talk about the aftermath of last week's vote and all the discussion and debate and Sturm und Drang that led up to it this morning. And we'll get your opinion on this as well. My guest is Cal Gilson, professor of political science at Southern Methodist University. He's the author of Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries. Professor Gilson, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me this morning.
It's good to be with you, John.
So last week, President Obama signed a two-month extension on the payroll tax break, and we're going to look at the politicking behind the deal, what's going to happen at the end. A sampling of the headlines, let's start with that, because it's pretty clear what the headline writers thought. Payroll tax fight leaves Hill Republicans divided and angry. That's the Washington Post. Let's see. We have another one here. GOP walks away from payroll tax debacle. Bruised. That was actually from a story that appeared on NPR. New York Times, victory considerably aided by the other side. That's just a sampling of what was out there. It's pretty clear the Democrats won this round, but it was one of their rare victories in 2011, wasn't it?
Well, I think that's exactly the right point, John, because this is the extension of a fight that's been going on since the Republican majority took control of the U.S. House a year ago, and the Republicans have won most rounds. This was an extension of a series of fights on spending, deficits, and debt, extension of the Bush tax cuts, and those kinds of questions. And the Republicans in the House, particularly the Tea Party wing of the Republican majority, has really dug in their heels and defeated the Democrats most times, but they missed a bet here in this latest round, where they stood against renewal of the 2% reduction in Social Security withholding, extension of unemployment rates, and a series of related issues. Even the Republicans in the Senate were against them. The Wall Street Journal editorial page was against them, and so they had to cave, giving Obama a relatively rare victory.
Well, is one of the problems that the Democrats have had is the seeming disconnect at times between the rank-and-file Democrats that are left in the House and the ones, if anyone's in control of the Senate, the ones in the Senate. There's been a disconnect between them and the president where he seems to have blinked a number of times instead of standing firm on some of these issues and forcing things one way or another. Is this a case where they finally got they all got the same hymnal and were in the same key, or was this just luck?
Yeah, I think that President Obama, from his initial election, had the sense that if he were to take a very thoughtful, rational position and articulate it convincingly to the American public, that Congress would follow his lead. The Democrats certainly would be with him, and the Republicans would see the logic of his positions and give him most of what he wanted. But Mitch McConnell, the leader, Republican leader in the Senate, from the very beginning stood four square against the president. John Boehner, the Republican leader in the House, has thought about compromising with President Obama a couple times, but has never been able to carry his Republican caucus with him. So the Republicans have been able to checkmate the Democrats on a relatively regular basis. But this time they went just a step too far, because Republicans almost always stand for tax cuts, almost never stand for tax increases. And so President Obama and the Democrats and even the Republicans in the Senate saw this most recent conflict as a question of whether or not to raise Social Security withholding taxes back to their normal level or to retain the 2% reduction that has been in place the last couple of years. The House Republicans thought, here's another chance to beat President Obama, but they were isolated in the end and had to cave.
Some House Republicans say they feel sold out by their counterparts in the Senate. Is that you used the term rational the other just a moment ago? Is that a rational view for them to take?
Well, from their perspective, it's a rational view to take. But from the perspective of the average citizen, I don't think it is. There is a Tea Party caucus embedded within the Republican majority in the House, and that Tea Party caucus is 50 to 75 members, depending upon the vote. And they believe that they were sent to Congress, mostly in the 2010 elections, to change the way Washington works. And that generally means to keep taxes low, to reduce spending in Washington, and to reduce the role of Washington in the states and in the lives of individual citizens. And they've been pretty much willing to use any means to get that done, and have won a series of fights. But I think that the idea that they would allow the Social Security withholding to increase 2%, costing 160 million Americans an average of $1,600 or so a year, was a failure for them.
800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion. How do you feel, or how do you see the outcome and the aftermath of the dispute over the payroll tax situation? How do you see it? How did you look at this as this debate unfolded in the national media? How did you perceive it? Which side were you on, and why? Why don't you give us a call and let us know at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. There's also a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and you can leave a comment there as well. My guest is Cal Gilson, professor of political science at Southern Methodist University, author of Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries. Again, the number 800-486-8655. So the Republicans were forced to come back. The House Republicans were forced to come back, were forced more or less to come back and take a vote that they didn't really want to take. But they did. In the end, the tax cut stays in place. And so how does this play out, do you think, in the next 8 months as we get the run-up to the 2012 election? Is this going to be an issue that the Democrats are going to be able to make enough hay out of in order to achieve their goal of retaking the House, or at least making sure that President Obama gets a second term?
Well, I think that within the last 2 or 3 weeks, as some economic indicators have begun to improve, as layoffs have slowed and the economy has seemed to pick up a little bit, and the Republicans have shown themselves to be very intransigent on this issue, President Obama's approval ratings have ticked up from the low 40s up to 46, 47. Some polls even show him flirting with 50%, which is a mark that analysts generally say a president needs to be at or very near if they're going to be comfortable in a reelection fight. So President Obama has done better in his polling as the economy seems to begin to start improving a little more convincingly, and the Republicans have continued to oppose him vehemently. But I think as we go forward over the next 8 months, the question is, does the economy continue to improve and do more people feel the benefits of it in their daily life? And if that happens over the early months of 2012, then I think President Obama will be in a very tight, close fight for reelection. But if the economy continues to lag and unemployment remains up in that 8.6 range rather than falling through say 8%, I think it'll be difficult for President Obama to be reelected.
All right, we have some callers lined up. Let's start in Stevens Point and hear what Joseph has to say. Joseph, thanks for joining me this morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, well, go ahead.
Just listening to the conversation, I've been trying to follow pretty closely to what's been going on. And what I've seemed to notice is that the whole issue has to center around this idea of one-upsmanship. And it's been like this for the, you know, since the 2008 election. And you saw it come to a head this year. And as a Wisconsinite, we had this thing with Scott Walker or whatever. But, you know, the real problems just aren't really getting solved on Capitol Hill. I mean, not only do we have still an 8.6% unemployment rate, which is, I mean, how the Bureau of Labor Statistics wants to put it, and, you know, there's certain problems to go into that, but we're not solving unemployment, but we also have this huge debt thing, and we've almost run out of fiscal and monetary policy to solve any future problems, and we still have to deal with Europe, the environment, and nothing just seems to get done. And that's, I guess, the big problem, and no one wants to do it.
All right, Joseph, thanks for the call. I think Joseph speaks for a lot of people who are just kind of frustrated. They see a lot of problems, but mostly what they see is partisan bickering.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. And Joseph made a number of important points that show up in public approval ratings of Congress as well as the president. The approval ratings of Congress tend to be in the teens. And people wonder who those people are who approve of the way Congress works. Both political parties are in the 20s or 30s, with the Republicans being a little lower than the Democrats. And as I said, President Obama is in the 40s. But what most Americans see is a dysfunctional political system in Washington where the parties are more interested, as Joseph said, in one-upsmanship in blocking the other party's proposed solutions than in, I think, what President Obama thought he would be able to do when he's elected and what John Boehner has tried to do a couple of times, which is to have the leaders of the two parties of Congress and the two political branches of government, the executive and the legislative branch, sit down together in a room and hash it out in a way that gives neither party or no political leader all that what they wanted, but comes with a plausible solution that will attenuate a problem, begin to deal with it, get the economy back on track so that Americans can quit watching the fighting in Washington and worry about their job search or their job performance, their daily life. And so Joseph touched on some really important issues that lead to a certain amount of pox on both your houses attitude toward government in Washington.
Yeah, and I don't know that started in 2008. It seems like this hyper-partisanship goes back quite a few years before then, at least into the early 80s, maybe going back to the Nixon administration. I don't know, but it does certainly seem like we've had an awful long period of what has essentially been gridlock in the nation's capital.
Yeah, there isn't a, I'll use this phrase only once during the hour, there is a substantial literature in political science on what's called polarization, which is the division between the parties in Congress, and it has gone up and down over the country's history, but the current polarization traces back into the late 70s, coming up through the Reagan years, and Republicans would argue that during the Bush presidency, the most recent Bush presidency, the Democrats stood against most of what President Bush wanted to do. And Democrats certainly believe that, as Mitch McConnell said in the weeks after President Obama was first elected, that he was going to dedicate himself to making Obama a one-term president. So Democrats see Republicans as being unwilling to compromise, but Republicans say, if you just think back to Bush, Democrats were as well. But it leaves us right where Joseph said we were, which is with a polarization in Congress that doesn't seem to allow the parties to focus on the nation's problems and their solution.
We're talking about the payroll tax fight, which just concluded. At least for now, one of the issues we're going to try to address here coming up later in the hour is what happens when this latest stopgap measure is at its end, which will be at the end of February. Congress will just have been back in session about a month. They still have to negotiate something for after the end of February. What's that likely to be like, given how things went this time? We'll have to see how that plays out, but I'm sure the professor has some thoughts on that. We have a number of people who have called in and want to be with us on the program. We'll get to those calls in just a moment. There will be room for you shortly at 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, coming up later on in the Ideas Network, Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. A special encore edition of Here on Earth, Jean Farrakh and her guests discuss what it means to grow up Scandinavian in the Midwest. This hour we're talking about the fight over the payroll tax break with Cal Gilson, professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and author of Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries. Phone lines are full, but you can still send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave a comment or a question at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. All right, Professor, let's go back to the phones, and we'll hear from Clyde in Grafton. Clyde, good morning.
Good morning. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everyone.
And to you.
This issue about the payroll tax revealed the remarkably revealed the hypocrisy of the Republican Party and the especially the Tea Party wing with regard to tax cuts and their opposition to any kind of tax cuts. However, it is also, and importantly, it's also really an ironic demonstration of the. Of the futility of the Democratic approach, which is to claim victory in this case, claim victory of a tax cut, which undercuts the funding of the most important programs that uphold our social safety net, our Social Security and our Medicare and Medicaid. This destruction of the underpinnings and the support structure for the very substantial, well-funded programs that we need that serve the people is not really a victory for the people, although the Democratic Party is claiming it as a victory for itself. It's where people are really pushed into a corner, and I think it demonstrates that the that we're not a democracy, that our government is currently owned, all three branches of our government is currently controlled by the by corporate powers and by the super rich, which are undermining the things in government which are important to us, while further exacerbating and increasing the divide and the diversity, the separation between wealth and income of the super rich and all the rest of us.
Clyde, thanks for the call. Professor?
I have been coming on Wisconsin Public Radio since the late 90s, and one of the reasons that I enjoy it so much is the intelligence and the thoughtfulness of the callers. And both Joseph and Clyde so far have put their fingers on important issues. I'm not sure I'm with Clyde in the end of his statement about the country not being a democracy completely controlled by corporate power. But the early questions, I think, were, the early part was right on, and that is I also think that although the Democrats are claiming a big victory here over the Republicans, that they are fundamentally out of position for the debate that is going to be held between now and November. Because the Republican Party for decades has stood for tax cuts and deregulation. Those tax cuts occurred during the Bush administration. Deregulation was another major set of policy proposals in the Bush administration, and the end of that administration saw an economic collapse, which should have allowed the Democrats to criticize both the tax cuts and the deregulation as at least insufficient and certainly not a full policy prescription. But the Democrats in this particular fight are arguing that they stood for tax cuts against Republican tax raisers, which nobody really believes. I think the Democrats going forward have to stand for the mature position, which is that because we have a slow-moving economy, we needed to engage in deficit spending. The deficits of the last couple of years were intended to be stimulative, but everybody knew we then had to turn to deficit control. And deficit control will require both revenue increases and very substantial spending cuts. And to be talking so much about tax cuts when you know you're going to have to stand for revenue increases, even tax increases in the coming months, and substantial cuts to signature programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is where I think the Democrats have to be taken to be a mature party against Republicans who are continuing to offer tax cuts and deregulation, which I don't think the public is going to buy in this cycle.
Well, the cynic in me would ask the question, when was the last time anyone got elected by being honest about what was really going on? But I suppose I probably better leave that.
No, that's exactly right, particularly among Republicans. They point back to George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, who agreed to a tax increase and was defeated for re-election. So that is very much the common wisdom. It's very much the normal case in American politics. But we're at, we hope, the end of a 2 or 3 year very serious recession where people are focused on deficits and long-term debt. And so a political party that can talk in a mature way about how to combat those difficulties, I think, can be taken seriously, whereas they might be in great danger. But it's very smart, John, talk about the fact that in the normal case, Republicans have always benefited by saying those Democrats are going to raise your taxes.
Well, and I go all the way back to Walter Mondale running against Ronald Reagan, and Walter Mondale coming out directly and saying, listen, if you want these programs, you have to pay for them, and here's how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And he got crushed. What he said was true. I mean, if you want this much government service, then here's the bill.
Yeah.
And then you had on the other side saying government's the problem, we're going to get them off your back, and we're going to lower your taxes, and everything's going to be fine if we go ahead and do that, and you see how that worked.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And if you step back a little bit further, the American public was thinking in terms of Jimmy Carter and stagflation, which Ronald Reagan elected in 1980, along with the Fed, very painfully broke the back of inflation by increasing unemployment, bring down interest rates. And by 84, Reagan was able to campaign on Morning in America and the return of growth against Mondale, who reminded people of Jimmy Carter. So I absolutely agree that in the normal case, the Republicans benefit by promising no new taxes and to get the government off your back, deregulation, all of that. But toward the end of the most recent Bush administration, those policies were subject to very grave question because of the economic collapse. And I think that President Obama missed a march which a Franklin Roosevelt or a Lyndon Johnson, a more instinctive go-for-the-throat politician, would have grabbed to push back on the Republican Party in their normal themes.
I think Ron and Toma, who's next here, has a great follow-up to our previous caller. Ron, go ahead.
Yes, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. My comment is the $115 billion that was taken out of the general fund due to the Social Security reduction in the last year, from 6.2 to 4.2%, and I'm just wondering what money tree they're going to get this money out of. I'm 62, paid Social Security for 50 years since I was 12 years old, yet, and I had to pay the 6.2%. It looks like maybe I'm going to have to work till 80. Maybe I'll be lucky and die by then so I don't have to pay any more taxes. But it makes little logical sense. There's nobody with common sense in Washington. That is evident by the bills and the 20% that is wasted out of our total budget, thrown down, wasted by all of government, and I'm sick of it. I'm an independent, and the only one that's putting a policy on the table that makes any sense is Paul Ryan, and then he gets shot down for using good economic sense, because nobody else has any, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Ron's asking, where's the money going to come from to pay for this? And that's a question on a lot of people's minds. I guess it depends on who you ask, doesn't it, Professor?
Yeah, it does. But first I want to say to Ron that I'm 62 as well, and I hate to hear 62-year-olds talking about dying. So we want to be careful. We've got a long ways to go. And I do think we're going to get Social Security. So people in their 60s will get Social Security. Because that program is in a position to pay 73% of its promised benefits out into the 2030s, and could be adjusted relatively easily to be secure for decades to come. The real problem is healthcare expenses. But what Ron is referring to quite correctly is that Social Security is now very near break-even, paying out as much as comes in with the 6.2% tax of individuals and a similar amount from employers. So it has been in the red for the last couple of years because with employment down, Social Security receipts have been down as well. And all of the surpluses that Social Security has accumulated over the last 20 years or so have been spent by Congress. So any deficit in Social Security comes out of general revenues, and we're running a $1.2 trillion deficit. So that money is being borrowed either from Americans who buy treasury bonds, from the Chinese, or from somebody, and has to be paid back at some point. So we have very serious fiscal problems, but that does not mean that Social Security will not be there for people nearing retirement age, and I think will be there for the next generation as well.
And if we talk about the battle over this most recent vote to retain the tax holiday, which is how one way is being described, the biggest difference was in how it would be paid for. The Republicans wanted to do it one way. The Democrats wanted to do it another. I think it seemed to me that both parties were interested in maintaining this. But the big argument, although that didn't get a lot of coverage in the press, the big argument was over how to pay for it.
Yes, that's right. And the Democrats had an advantage on that argument, because what the Democrats were talking about here and have been talking about since President Obama was elected was to increase taxes on the very wealthy. Now, sometimes that is described as people making more than $200,000 or $250,000 a year. In this case, it was defined as people making more than $1 million a year. And about 75% of Americans in most polling believe that the wealthy are in a position to pay more in taxes. So the Democrats were talking about taxing the wealthy. The Republicans had a more complicated scheme that was generally to freeze the pay of federal government employees and reduce federal government employment over the coming years. But I think that in that debate, again, the Democrats had the advantage, and that was one of the reasons that the Republicans sort of lost rhetorical leverage and had to cave on this.
And there was also, I believe that they were also pushing a provision to means test some Medicare services, were they not?
Well, there Republicans, two points. One, the first broader point is that when the Republicans are arguing that they are protecting Social Security, most voters know that Social Security was a Franklin Roosevelt Democratic Party program built and protected by the Democrats for the last 70 years against some reservations that the Republicans have always had. So when Republicans argue they're protecting Social Security, that's not a lot of leverage for them. But Republicans have always argued that the large federal government programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are too expensive. They're unsustainable. And one way to make them somewhat less expensive is to means test them for the very wealthy. But that's not an argument that the Republicans stick with across time and across debates. It's a lever that they were using at this point to argue that they were being more fiscally responsible. And what Democrats hear when Republicans say means test Social Security is, rather than making it something that everyone has a claim on, the way Ron talked about just a minute ago, because they paid into it, to make it more like a welfare program that only the poor look forward to receiving. So means testing is a way to take Social Security from being a social insurance program that everyone who pays into draws off of, to being a more of a welfare-style program, more easily cut in future periods when budgets are tight.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Jackson this time and hear from Steve. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Great program. I was just wondering why your guest feels that there is a bipartisan effort, and in the White House also, to defund Social Security through reducing the payroll tax, as they call it, when it's not a tax, it's actually a funding process. And couldn't they possibly get this money from, like, raising the general tax or income tax, like 0.5%? And that's my question.
Thanks,
yes,
Steve.
They, you know, if you think about it intellectually, they certainly could do that, and that would be a more responsible way to approach it. That would be moving in the direction of, if we want these services, we have to be willing to pay for them with an increase in the general income tax, for example. But the Republicans would fight against that tooth and nail. Many Democrats would think that they increase their exposure in the coming election if they supported that. And so a decrease in the Social Security tax, Democrats and Republicans have thought of as stimulating the economy during difficult economic times. And it's not actually being defunded, because you're getting the revenues to pay Social Security's responsibilities from the general treasury. But many Democrats are concerned that once you lower the payroll tax for a year and now for 2 years, it will be difficult to get Republicans and some Democrats to raise it back up to its normal 6.2% from individuals, and that will effectively defund it or reduce the revenue stream to it in the coming years.
Steve, thanks for that call. We have others on the line, and I'll ask you to just be patient. We'll get to your calls as soon as possible. We need to take a short break here. A line just opened up if you'd like to try to get in, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the recent battle over the extension of the payroll tax break, which came to a head just before Christmas. President Obama signing the two-month extension last Friday. One of the things I want to get to after the break, Professor, is to talk about, okay, what happens now when Congress comes back And let's try to frame the discussion a little bit there, and then we have other callers who want to get in as well. 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, the UW Weather Guy visit with Larry Mueller. There's been lots of interesting meteorological activity lately, including fog bows, the recent full lunar eclipse, lightning sprites, and more, plus the top weather events in Wisconsin for 2011. That's coming up next hour with Larry Mueller. This hour, we're talking about the payroll tax holiday, which was extended for 2 months. President Obama signed that into law last Friday and was considered a big victory for the president and for the Democrats. Cal Gilson, professor of political science at Southern Methodist University and author of Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries, is my guest. And, Professor, before we go back to the phones, I want to make sure that we don't run out of time without having touched on the topic of, okay, we bought 2 months. What happens next, and how is the debate likely to be framed when Congress comes back from its holiday?
Yeah, I think that sometime in late February we'll have to go through this same debate again. I don't think that it will last as long because everyone in Washington is focused on the November elections, and the attempt this time was to extend the payroll tax cut and unemployment benefits for a year. And so I think they will do that unless Republicans can find a better argument about how to pay for these extensions. I expect the extension to take place because the Democrats won. They're going to want to sustain the idea that these tax cuts are a benefit to 160 million working Americans, and unless Republicans can find a better set of arguments against doing it, they will say these tax cuts are a Republican idea. So I think those will continue. But I do think that there's an element of this that is a weakness for the Democrats, and that is the Keystone XL pipeline. One of our callers talked about environmental concerns earlier, and I think that that the Keystone pipeline, as your listeners will know, is bringing Canadian tar sands oils down to the Gulf Coast for refinement and use, mostly within the United States. And that was set to be approved a couple of months ago. President Obama and the State Department put it off until after the election, because it divided the Democrats' union supporters who want the jobs of building the pipeline from the Democrats' environmentalist supporters who are worried about its implications for the Oglala Aquifer, which underlies much of the Midwest. And I think the Democrats are wrong to stop that pipeline because we do need those energy sources. I think that the environmental consequences of pipelines can be dealt with. We know how to do that. And the president would have looked stronger if he had made a decision, I think, in favor of that pipeline. And that would have taken an argument away from the Republicans.
Well, David in Dubuque wants to talk about exactly that topic. And David, go ahead.
Okay, thanks so much for taking my call. And I'm glad you brought it up right now because I have some pretty strong feelings about this this creation of, you know, so many jobs that the Speaker Boehner is talking about. And the recent report I found from the State Department said there are probably only going to be 6,000 jobs coming out of that whole project for the pipeline. And maybe only 50, they talk about 50 permanent jobs. And so I think the Republicans are being unfair in talking about this kind of a job creation with our economic crisis going on. And the second thing I would like to say is some of the studies that have been done on the environment, though, are saying that these tar sands could release like 230 billion tons of carbon. And James Hansen from NASA says this could be game over. So I do think it's pretty strong argument. And the second argument I was reading a little bit about a professor from the University of Nebraska who said that even if there was a tiny undetected leak in this pipe, it could contaminate 5 billion gallons of drinking water. And so I guess I feel pretty strong about these arguments that, you know, first of all, it's unfair for Republicans to bring it in, and then there should be a lot more research done about the effects of this pipeline on the environment. So I'll take my answer off the air. I'm just kind of curious
Thanks.
What you have to say about that.
Thanks, David. Professor?
Yeah, thank you, David. I said what I said in order to stir up a little bit of controversy. I didn't expect it to take only 10 seconds, though. That was really great. I think that a couple of points. One of them is that the tar sands in Canada have a tremendous energy resource that is going to be tapped. And the question is whether or not the results of tapping those tar sands resources are going to go in a pipeline west through Canada to their coast and then transshipment to China, which is what the Canadian authorities are saying will happen and is in the process of happening now if we don't build the pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline through the Midwest to our refinery capacity in the Texas Gulf Coast. So it's not that if we don't do the pipeline that those tar sands are not going to be tapped. They are. And I do think that if there were to be a breach in the pipeline and it were to get into the aquifer, which is huge, and runs from Nebraska down into the panhandle of Texas, it could foul a lot of water. But I don't think we can be driven by the worst-case scenario of a few drips of oil ruining this huge aquifer. And it might be more than a few drips, I realize that, but I do think that we can manage the environmental consequences. And we are in a position as a country now with the natural gas discoveries and new oil discoveries are really making an advance against our dependence on foreign oil, and our North American reserves, to include Canadian, are going to be tapped. So it's a serious issue, but I think it should be treated as a serious issue, not as a political issue, and I think the reason it was set back a year was politics.
All right, we have an email from Anthony in Sherwood. I think that speaks to something that you alluded to just a little while ago, Professor, before we got onto the pipeline question. Anthony writes, President Obama and the Democrats did not win a rare victory. Rather, they walked into a strategic trap led by the fiscal right, who are scheming to privatize Social Security. When it comes time to restore the Social Security payroll tax, the Republicans will vilify the Democrats as raising taxes on the American people, just as it has proved impossible to restore the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy. The Democrats, I don't think he meant to say restore, rescind might be a better word there. Democrats will be bullied into keeping the payroll tax cut permanently. The net effect will be to starve Social Security and hasten the day it will become insolvent. At that point, the Republicans will propose a privatized Social Security system for younger workers, and since younger workers will no longer contribute to the pensions of the already retired, it will become necessary to cut benefits to existing Social Security beneficiaries. Yes, the Democrats have fallen into a strategic trap, and retirees will suffer for it.
Well, I think that Anthony sketches out a real danger that cutting the revenue stream into Social Security, which is attractive during an economic downturn because it's seen to be stimulative in economists, although, you know, over the last 3 years, you want to be a little careful about listening to the economist's view of how the economy works, I think, indicate that if we didn't continue the Social Security cuts, it would reduce GDP growth in 2012 by about a percentage point. So the reason to cut is to stimulate the economy during difficult times. And what Anthony is arguing is that the Democrats will not be able to restore the revenue flows into Social Security and that will strengthen the argument that Republicans traditionally make about the fact that Social Security isn't viable long-term and we need to privatize. But I think two things. One is we saw when President Bush talked about privatization of Social Security in 2000, what was that, 5 and 6, that the public reaction was extraordinarily negative because Social Security is the most popular federal government program on the books. And secondly, I think that the Democrats didn't sleepwalk into a Republican trap because the Republicans didn't know they were setting a trap, certainly didn't act like they had successfully set a trap. So I think that the Democrats are at least marginally brighter than Anthony is suggesting, and they will have to come up with an argument about why it's important to increase the funding stream to Social Security when the time comes, and we'll see if they're able to do that.
All right. Well, we'll take another call here from a fellow Texan of yours. Steve from Houston is on the line. Steve, welcome.
Yeah, good morning. Hi. I'm a small business owner, and small businesses are known to create some 50% of the new jobs. And I'm also kind of a supporter of the Tea Party and kind of the Mitt Romney wing of the Republican Party that is trying to find a way to make businesses functioning. I think this whole argument is missing the point. And the Republicans are pushing this, Mitt Romney has, is that there have been just a wave of regulations certainly affecting the energy industry, as we just talked about, attempting to shut down the banking industry and making small businesses, becoming basically, a lot of them have been frozen up by the new model regulations, you know, the food industry. You know, I've gotten 3 or 4 notices of new regulations that have come, and I'm in the floral industry. I mean, the Obama administration didn't pass the treaty with Colombia for over a year, and it made the whole industry go upside down. So my point is this, you know, this whole thing is just a Band-Aid when our economy is dead. I mean, I read that 50,000 corporations have left America or went out of business in the last decade. That's corporations. And, you know, our manufacturing industry is collapsing. So the real issue is, you know, I mean, and this tax, you know, this 2% rebate in taxes is great. I certainly appreciate it, but it does absolutely nothing to create jobs. And that's the whole issue here, is how you create jobs. This is just another big welfare handed out by the Obama administration. All of his focus has been on expanding the role of the federal government and freezing, you know, those businesses like mine that create jobs. That's the fundamental issue, is how do you create jobs? You can't
you can't raise
taxes or cut taxes, you know, to get out of this problem. You've got to create jobs or our country doesn't have a future.
Well, hang on, Steve. Before we let you go, I want to ask you, who are your customers, and where do they get their money?
What does that have to do with it? Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that
if I can't create jobs, then we have 18%, 20% true unemployment. If there isn't jobs, we're going to run out of money. You know, that money came out of my children's future, right? That money isn't there. We're creating money out of nothing. We're borrowing it from China. We either find a way to create jobs, or we're going to run out of money. We're printing money that we don't have.
Okay, Steve, thanks. Professor?
Yeah, there are a number of issues, and the idea that 50,000 corporations, for example, have left the country, 50,000 corporations, or went out of business, 50,000 companies go out of business every 10 years. Ours is a dynamic economy, and Joseph Schumpeter talked about creative destruction, that a lot of corporations are going to go out of business even in a good economy and be replaced by newer, more modern corporations selling things that people want. So I think that the reason for the tax cut was to help stimulate the economy so that more people would have more income, they could take it into the marketplace and buy goods and services, and that would stimulate additional hiring in businesses. So, and the idea that small businesses create 60 to 70% of new jobs, as it's usually described, is true, but a little bit misleading, because small businesses are defined by the federal government as up to 500 employees. most times when people hear the phrase small business, they're not thinking of businesses that employ 400 or 500 people. So the economy does need to be stimulated, but the idea that cutting taxes and reducing regulations are the best way to do it made a lot more sense back in the Kennedy administration, when Kennedy reduced tax rates from the 92% in Eisenhower to 70, and then when Reagan reduced them to 50% and then to 35%. From 35% at the top marginal tax rate, it makes much less sense to talk about further reductions in taxes. And I think we did see that we needed more regulations on the banks and the financial institutions than we had when they led the collapse of the economy in 2008 and 2009. So what we need is smart tax policy and smart regulatory policy, not necessarily less of either one.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it, Professor. Thanks so much for joining me. Cal Gilson, professor of political science at Southern Methodist University, author of Pursuing the American Dream, Opportunity and Exclusion Over Four Centuries. Chrissy Peace produced this hour of programming and handled on-air production as well. And thank you also to Rhonda Fanning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.